Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're diving into a really detailed collection of excerpts focusing on early Islamic history.
That's right. We're looking at key figures like Muhammad, major events, conflicts.
All seen through the specific lens of this particular source material you've shared with us. Our mission, really, is to pull out the most important insights and, honestly, some surprising facts from this narrative.
Think of it as a shortcut, maybe, to understanding this distinct historical perspective.
Exactly. We want to explore how faith, power, and community formation all kind of intertwined based just on these accounts.
And it really is a specific lens, you know. The source gives details, interpretations. It shapes the history in a very distinct way. You might not find these perspectives elsewhere.
Okay, so let's jump right in. Where does this source begin its story? It takes us back, way back.
To creation. Before time even existed, apparently. Just nothingness. Then boom, this explosion of light expanding everywhere.
And from the center of that nothingness, God appears, majestic.
Right. And then this formless mass hidden in smoke is brought before God. It's a very vivid image to start with.
And the source presents this idea that Adam and God are like veils for each other.
Yeah, it explicitly says solving Adam reveals God. It connects human existence and the divine really directly in quite a unique way here.
The narrative then zooms out a bit, describing this divine realm, a throne, an emerald rainbow.
24 other thrones around it. With angels in white clothes, gold crowns.
Lightning, thunder from the main throne, 7 flaming torches.
And to underline God's power, it quotes Aref 754, the creation of heavens and earth in 6 days. Standard stuff there, but setting the stage.
And then the creation of the caliph on earth, Adam. But the angels question it.
They do. They ask, essentially, are you sure he's going to cause mischief, bloodshed? It sets up a tension right away.
And God's response is basically, I know something you don't.
Yeah.
He asked them to name things, proving his point.
Yeah, asserting a knowledge the angels just don't have.
Adam's early time in paradise sounds, well, quite detailed in this source.
Yeah.
Wanting to touch birds, being taken up by angels.
Hiras bringing him roasted bird meat on golden trays when he's hungry. It's very specific.
And he asks about these amazing palaces near tuba trees with roots in the sky.
Right. And the answer, referencing this pre-written book, the Livy Mahfuz, is that they're furnished based on the price the owners will pay.
Specifically for those who kill or are killed for God.
It ties paradise directly to sacrifice and struggle right from the start in this narrative.
Jibril pops up early, too. Adam remembers him fighting devils in paradise.
And there's that odd exchange. Adam asks Jibril why he's just watching the Huris, not, you know.
And Jibril says,
God created me only to observe. It's a line that comes up again later. Adam sort of implies Jibril's missing out.
There's also the warning about Satan, the enemy trying to get them kicked out of paradise. Unhappiness follows. That's linked to Taha 21:17.
And a very human moment described. Adam feels strange, asks Eve if she'd prostrate to him, but God vanishes before she answers. Kind of awkward.
And Eve's initial take on Adam, not impressed.
Finds him large, unattractive, surprised the Huris are into him. Quite blunt, really.
So the source wraps this section by reflecting on God's plan. The angels didn't get it, but the forbidden fruit incident.
The fury over this apparently useless tree, maybe one that sheds hair, it was all planned.
And Adam's ambition for decision-making power. The source suggests this makes him potentially more dangerous than Iblis.
Leading God to think he created a perfect rival in Adam, someone who resembled him, unlimited desires. It's a really powerful, almost unsettling take on the Adam story.
It definitely reframes it. And slipped in near the beginning, there's this assertion linked to Spinoza's research.
That Ezra wrote the Torah and the next 7 books around the 6th century BC, just stated right there.
Okay, so from creation in these deep origins, the source shifts. It moves to the world Muhammad enters around Mecca, talks about the UKIDS fair.
Yeah, this fair near Taif sounds like a vital hub. 20 days every year, Zilqa'd 1st to 20th.
Caravans, poetry contests, trade.
Political announcements, resolving disputes, tribal promotion. It was the place to be, it seems.
But alongside all that worldly stuff, there's this underlying fear.
A deep fear of apocalypse, yeah. Based on stories from the Torah and Gospel about past nations being destroyed, Noah, Lut, Ad, Thamud, Iram.
People saw those as proof judgment was coming.
And they worried that current disobedience, like fewer people praying or fasting, was angering God, maybe even more than past rebellions. The source paints them as genuinely afraid of waking up to the end times.
Then we get Muhammad's encounter with Muzab bin Osman, who knew the poet Umayyah bin Abi Salt. Umayyah's reaction is telling.
fiercely jealous when he hears Muhammad claims prophethood, turns pale apparently, and yells, "Prophethood was my right,"
and storms off to Yemen in anger.
Takes his kids, too. It shows the intense competition around religious authority back then, according to this account.
The persecution of early Muslims is described pretty brutally.
Yeah, the source doesn't hold back. It mentions Umar ibn Khattab beating slave women, Zunira and Lubayna, trying to force them to renounce Islam.
Stopping only when he got tired, but threatening to come back.
It highlights the physical danger, especially for the vulnerable converts.
Abu Talib's protection is mentioned, trying to downplay the threat to the Quraysh leaders.
Saying, you know, their fears were overblown. Hardly anyone believed Muhammad yet.
Which leads to that ultimatum.
Right. The Quraysh leaders tell Abu Talib, make Muhammad stop criticizing our fathers, our gods, calling us foolish, or else.
Or we fight both of you until one side's destroyed. Very direct.
Then there's the complex incident, the alleged satanic verses. Mm-hmm. How does the source present that?
It says Muhammad was saddened by a mistake, Jibril pointed out. People started asking, wait, can messengers make mistakes?
And Muhammad explains Jibril corrected him about verses he'd read concerning the idols Lot, Uzzah, and Manat.
He read them suggesting their intercession was hoped for exalted cranes, but Jibril said, no, I didn't bring those verses. Presented as a correction, human fallibility.
Umar ibn Khattab's conversion story is dramatic too. Not exactly peaceful.
Far from it. Hits his sister, Ummu Jamil. Her husband Saeed steps in, says Umar can't force people unless he's right.
Umar attacks Saeed, and then the sister, Ummu Jamil, intervenes again.
And declares her own conversion right there, even after being beaten. Intense family drama and conviction.
Okay, so leading up to the Hijrah, the migration, the meeting with the Khazraj tribe from Medina at Aqaba.
Yeah, they talk about Medina's problems. Big internal issues, external threats.
The source points out the Jewish influence, their presence, their impact on Arab tribes, their role in trade. Crucial context.
And that long, seemingly endless war with the Oz tribe.
Right. So the Khazraj see Muhammad as maybe a neutral leader, someone who could fix things.
So they offer him protection. The Aqaba Pledge.
And based on that promise, Muhammad asks them to prepare things in Medina, sends Muzab bin Umar to teach the religion.
And the migration happens because of that guarantee of safety.
Okay, so we're in Medina, and one of the first major events described is the Miraj, the Ascension.
A pretty extraordinary event. Muhammad recounting his journey, half asleep.
Being brought the Burak, this creature, bigger than a donkey, smaller than a mule, taken by Jibril.
First to Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Then up to the heavens. Jibril asking for the gates to open at each level.
And that's where he gets the prayer instruction. Initially 50 times a day.
Reduced to 5, as Moses advises him. That's a famous part of the story.
And Jibril's line comes back again.
Only created to observe.
No.
Its repetition feels significant here, doesn't it? Maybe emphasizing different divine roles.
Could be. Then the Hijra itself. Muhammad and Abu Bakr meeting at night, hiding in the cave on Mount Thar for days.
Strategic move to escape pursuit. Amr ibn Hisham checks Muhammad's empty house. The next day, they knew he was gone.
Now, the Medina document. The source presents it as an agreement, sure, but with issues.
Underlying mistrust.
Yeah. Religion seen by some as a means to hidden ends. Losing a debate could mean ruin, even death. People avoiding real understanding.
And Jewish objections based on their scriptures specifically angered Muslims, it says, portrays a tense situation despite the formal pact.
Then comes the Battle of Badr. The source focuses on those initial duels.
Right, the one-on-one fights.
Yeah.
Ubaidah versus Utbah, Hamza versus Sheba, Ali versus Walid.
Hamza and Ali win quickly. Ubaidah gets wounded by Utbah.
And Hamza and Ali have to help Ubaidah finish Utbah off. Then Ubaidah is carried back to Muhammad. That focus on duels seems important in this telling.
The death of Amr ibn Hisham Abu Jahl is recounted too.
Abdullah ibn Mas'ud finds him dying, steps on his neck, declares God humiliated him.
And his reported dying words are interesting. Asking who won and noting that a great man killed by his own people. Well, it happens.
Yeah.
Implying the significance of his death.
There's an account of a Ghazi raid, too. Yeah. Captures the spirit.
Muslim raiders attack, kill someone named Harith, wound others. On the way back, the wounded Harith can't walk.
Asks them to send his greetings to Muhammad. His friends carry him.
And when they get back, shouting Takbir at the graveyard, Muhammad hears it while praying, says Takbir back, greets them at the mosque, smiling, faces have been saved, shows that camaraderie perceived divine favor.
Hind's plot against Hamza gets detailed treatment.
Offering her slave Washi freedom if he kills Hamza, who killed her father Utbah at Badr.
And the source emphasizes her specific plan to use a slave, someone outside the main battle to target Hamza. Strategic, personal.
The incident at Bir Mauna is mentioned. Three Muslims meeting Amir B. Tufail.
Haram B. Milhan warns his friends to stay back, delivers a letter inviting Amir to Islam.
And then the source just stops. Doesn't say what happened next. Leaves you hanging.
Then there's the incident about women's dress, leading to that verse in Nur.
A man complains about women in a women's area revealing clothes, noisy anklets, fears men might secretly watch. Another complaint about noisy anklets in the market.
Muhammad's reaction is silence, thought.
And then the revelation comes. Nur 24.31, lower gaze, guard modesty, cover bosoms, don't stamp feet to reveal hidden adornments like anklets.
Lists exceptions, commands repentance. The source directly links social complaints to divine guidance here.
Then the Battle of Banu Mustalik.
The source emphasizes the Muslim archer's success, the Mustalik struggling.
And makes a point. Not one Mustalik arrow hit the Muslims, protected by God and angels, it says. Mentions Ali and Muaz B. Jabal behind shields.
Eight Mustalik warriors killed, including Harith's brother Safwan. Their force scatters. Many flee, but one man, Musafi.
His heart full of bara, resists alone with a sword, then overwhelmed.
And the spoils division afterwards is clear-cut.
Muhammad takes 1/5 for the state treasury, the Beit al-Mal. The rest is divided. 2 shares for horsemen, 1 for foot soldiers. Shows that early system.
The question about coitus interruptus azil comes up. Abu Sayyid al-Khudri asks.
About using it with captured women, part of the spoils to avoid pregnancy. Some companions wondered if it was sinful, preventing a life.
Abu Sayyid mentions sleeping alone in the desert, wanting to satisfy needs.
But the source just presents the question. It doesn't give Muhammad's answer here. Another dangling thread.
Interesting. Then Bera's marriage proposal. A different fate for a captive.
Muhammad offers to marry her, a noble woman, instead of her being a slave. Says she deserves better.
And the source includes her perspective, remembering a dream of a full moon entering her bosom, seeing this as its fulfillment. An honor.
But she has a condition.
A big one. Muhammad has to free 100 captives.
And he agrees. Sees it as making her happy. A gesture of liberation tied to the marriage.
The story of Aisha's lost necklace also appears here, before the slander accusations.
Right. Her valuable Yemen agate necklace goes missing. The whole caravan stops to search.
Which causes delays, lack of water for prayer, and complaints to Abu Bakr about Aisha. Sets a certain stage, perhaps.
And that leads into the revelation about the slander against Aisha. Nur 24.1120.
Verses revealed after the incident with Safwan B. Mortal. Clears her name, warns believers strongly against spreading slander.
Mentions painful punishment for those wanting immorality to spread.
And after these verses, Muhammad summons the accused spreaders. Hassan B. Thabit, Humna binti Josh, Mustabi Yusasa. The source links it all together.
Okay, moving into later conflicts. The Battle of the Trench, or Azab, the big siege of Medina.
The source highlights moments like Amr shouting challenges across the trench, daring someone to fight for heroism or paradise.
And Ali steps up, asks Muhammad permission twice, gets his armor, his sword, Du Afikar.
And in the duel, Ali uses Amr's own customs against him, challenging him to accept one of two proposals. Clever.
Exactly. The source also goes into the internal dynamics, Nuaym's secret mission.
Sowing discord between the besiegers Quraysh, Ghatafan, and the Banu Qurayza inside Medina.
Telling the Qurayza, hey, if these guys leave, you're alone with the Muslims. What about your families, your wealth? Subtle manipulation described.
And the chat between Huaybi Akkab and Abu Sufyan about the Qurayza alliance.
Abu Sufyan, hesitant about fighting on the Sabbath, demands hostages. Huyai tries to persuade him, hopes for a dust storm, worries about explaining the hostage refusal back to the Qurayza, shows the fragile alliances.
The outcome of the trench. Surprisingly few casualties reported.
6 Muslims, 3 Quraysh dead, according to the source. Seen by Muslims as a reward from God for their belief. They pray together safely afterwards.
But then, the Banu Qurayza event. A very different, much harsher outcome. Dated specifically, April 15th, 627.
They ask Abu Lubaba for advice, he tells them. Surrender unconditionally. Some resist. Want to delay. Reject attacking on the Sabbath.
Kabi Asad decides to surrender, hoping for mercy. Nabash B.K.'s accepts the surrender.
The surrender scene itself is described with unsettling detail.
People leaving tied up. Rihanna helping Nubada, who's shaking, acting strange, like remembering his wedding dance.
Rihanna sees Abdul Haq among the captives, feels shame, feels Jehovah is ignoring them, fear but clinging to faith. Very raw emotion in the source's telling.
And the judgment.
Muhammad enters, states his judgment is based on a previous ruling. The judgment, kill adolescent males, enslave women and children, seize property as booty. Severe.
Labash BK's reaction is included quite a reflection.
Shocked. Sees it as a reversal of Torah law, where Jews were strong, decrees applied to others, now applied to Jews. Feels Yehovah didn't account for this. Reflects that oppressive powers always rise from ruthlessness.
Mm-hmm.
A distinct perspective from within the source.
The source then looks back at Mecca's situation after the Hijra.
Caravans blocked by Muslims controlling routes. Raids hurting morale. Tribal wars were familiar. But this war, in the name of religion, felt foreign, it says. Mecca shifts focus to survival. Peace.
The narrative keeps tracking expansion. Raids, conquests.
Mentions Abu Qatada's raid, kills Abd al-Rahman bi Uyana. But two Muslims die too. Muriz bi Nadla, Waqas bi Mujaziz.
The Fazara tribe flees, leaves camels, goods behind. Salama pursues, returns with spoils.
And a focus on Kaibar. Rich, powerful, especially after the expelled Banu Nadir Jews moved there.
The source suggests Muhammad was annoyed by Jewish prosperity, even suggesting they were maybe in league with Iblis.
Contrast Medina feeling less vibrant despite Muslims holding former Jewish property. Suggests Muhammad sought resources via raids while Jews flourished in their strongholds. That's the source's framing.
Hudaybiyah treaty events are mentioned briefly.
Muhammad following Salama's advice on sacrifice, shaving hair, people follow his example. On the way back, a revelation at Kiral Gamim, people get fearful.
Includes a letter supposedly from Muhammad to Kisra, the Persian emperor.
Saying past rulers got worldly portions, others focused on hereafter but got worldly stuff too. Worldly efforts differ, but all equal before divine justice later. Warns Kisra not to underestimate the message.
The arrival of gifts from Egypt gets attention, especially Maria.
Muhammad reportedly captivated, white-skinned, curly-haired, 20-something, calls her the most beautiful woman in Medina.
Keeps Maria for himself, gifts her sister Shireen to Hassan bi Thabit.
Presented as being in return for forgiving Safwan bi Muattal's blood money.
Houses Maria near the mosque, visits her more often than other wives, it says, seemingly charmed.
The trade in Kaibar is detailed. Goods from India, China, local crafts, livestock, jewelry, weapons, honey, wine, textiles, slaves.
Highlights the native market after Hajj attracting people from all over. Mentions Muhammad traded there himself. Underscores its importance.
Then the attack on Kaibar. Jews warned by Selim bi Mishkam urged to fight defensively. He advises where to put families, treasures, fighters, Katiba, Naim, Nita forts.
Muhammad offers Islam or jizya. Kaibar answers with arrows. First day, Mahmud bi Maslama wounded by Merhab throwing a millstone from the fort. Shows the defense.
Reactions when the Ghatafan tribe abandons the Kaibar alliance are included. Offers an internal Jewish perspective from the source.
Kinabi Abil Huquake regrets trusting these desert Arabs. Salim agrees. Mentions past unreliability, like with Banu Qurayza. His advice, never seek their help again.
Safiya's grief after Kaibar is noted, wishing she could bear Muhammad's pain.
Muhammad consoles her. And then, the source says, proceeds with his marriage to Ramla bint Abu Sufyan, who'd arrived from Abyssinia and was waiting.
Rivalries among the Muhajirun are also touched upon. Status competition. Abyssinian migrants versus earlier Medina migrants.
That anecdote. Asma bint Umayz meets Umar. Umar claims seniority for earlier Medina migration.
Asma retorts strongly about their suffering in Abyssinia for God and the messenger. Promises to ask Muhammad who's right, shows those social tensions.
Okay, nearing the end of Muhammad's life in this narrative and the complex period after, his Hajj sermon.
Declares Satan's influence lost on major matters, but warns about minor ones. Advises care for women's rights, they're a trust from God, honor lawful by covenant.
And men's rights alongside that. Women protecting family honor, not letting in unwelcome visitors. If they disobey on that point, men can lightly beat admonish. Women's rights to provision reiterated.
And during that Hajj, the big revelation, Quran 5.3, today I have perfected your religion. Believers rejoice.
But Abu Bakr and Umar weep, interpreting it as a sign Muhammad's death is near. Poignant detail.
Muhammad's second sermon at Mina is included too. Listen to the prophet, obey God's book, perform Hajj as he did. Says he probably won't perform Hajj again. Q&A follows.
The source notes increased security consciousness from Muhammad after an assassination attempt returning from Tibuk.
More precautions during Hajj due to crowds. But then later, he suddenly removes the guards. Aisha wonders why. Curious detail.
Which leads right into the succession crisis after his death. Intense conflict described.
Saad B. Ubadah claims leadership immediately. Umar threatens to crush him. Saad's son, Craze, grabs Umar's beard.
Abu Bakr's calls for softness. Saad curses them, says if he wasn't sick, he'd drive them out of Medina, make them subservient. His tribe carries him away from the discord.
Abbas offers Ali support, suggests bringing in Abu Sufyan.
Abu Sufyan's reaction to Abu Bakr's election is critical. Chaos, he calls it. Why the weakest guy from the smallest Quraysh clan?
Offers Ali cavalry and infantry, says Quraysh won't oppose if he backs Ali because Muslims follow Quraysh. Highlights that tribal thinking.
Abu Bakr's first moves as caliph.
Sends Usama B. Zayd's army back to Syria. That army had just returned from a successful 40-day raid on Christian Arab tribes, bringing wealth.
The source includes Abu Bakr meeting them, Usam recounting success, Umar embracing him as my commander. Then Abu Bakr starts gathering tribes for the Ridda Wars.
Musalima al-Kadhab's prophethood claim during the Ridda gets significant attention.
Says Rahman, God, chose him for his patience. His people, Banu Hanifa, believed him. His view of Muhammad.
Saw him as first gathering Quraysh, then all Arabs under his command alone. Intolerant of rivals, Musalima argues. We both invite to one God, hate idols. Why attack us?
Concludes Muhammad's aim was Arab dominance, not just faith. Suggests companions might have influenced him. Provides that rival perspective.
And Rajal B. Unfua's view is included, comparing Musalima's revelations from old texts detailed clear to Muhammad's fragmented citations unclear results.
Rajal preferred Musalima, the Rahman of Yama, saw clear evidence, chose to die for him. Another viewpoint presented.
Musalima meeting Saja bin Harith, the female prophet claimant.
Saja meets him veiled. Musalima claims God gave them half the earth, the other half Quraysh forfeited by injustice. Saja agrees, an alliance of prophets. Unique detail.
The Malik B. Nuera incident during Ridda Wars shows conflict over interpretation.
Malik surrenders, prays with Muslims. Abu Qatada argues against killing them. Khalid imprisons them, then executes them.
Khalid's justification, per the source. Another soldier said they lied, they were apostates, so property and women were lawful spoils.
Contrasted with Abu Bakr pardoning Ashathi Quays, who had fought Muslims but promised loyalty, even let him marry his sister. Different approaches shown.
Battle of Yama described, Abu Bakr sends Khalid. Musalima urges his tribe, fight for honor, protect your women. Details of fierce fighting mentioned.
The source also highlights a dispute between Abu Bakr and Umar. Early tensions.
Umar disagreed with some actions, like dividing spoils equally after the state's fifth when Umar wanted more from Muhajirun. Abu Bakr had to assert his authority, it says, make it clear who's caliph.
Umar's view on leadership. Commanders need strong God connection to establish a God-state line. Commanders feared Umar more than Abu Bakr, source says. Umar wanted to prevent Abu Bakr making mistakes.
Abu Sufyan keeps commenting on the leadership.
Tells Umar he knows he sidelined Ali Abbas for the most passive Quraysh guy, Abu Bakr. Calls it a hernia-inducing choice.
Umar agrees it was necessary then due to Saad B. Ubadah. Now Umar wants Uthman close to Abu Bakr, helping preventing others' influence. Ongoing politics.
Khalid's fame under Umar's caliphate is discussed. Complex picture. Commander in Iraq, then overall at Yarmouk, 50,000 troops.
Criticized other commanders' tactics at Yarmouk, said lead the whole army, not just units. His success made him legendary, unattainable myth in Medina.
But his fame worried Umar, overshadowing the state, religion.
Yeah, Umar saw it as a risk. Knew Muhammad hadn't given Khalid much initiative despite his skills. Saw Khalid as extravagant, reckless, devoted only to war. Fame gave confidence, but also fear. Nuanced view.
The adultery case involving Mughira B. Shuba and Umar's handling. Complex.
Accused by witnesses like Abu Bakr, Nafi, Shibul. Claimed they saw him in the act. Umar questions Abu Bakr rigorously. How exactly did you see? Standing, leaning out. Saw her head clearly.
Abu Bakr explains. Umar hears the others too.
Mughira appeals to the last witness, Ziyad B. Abi, beforehand. Reminds him of God, judgment. Asks him not to testify to what he didn't fully see. Urges truthfulness.
But the source. Yep. Again, doesn't give Ziyad's testimony or the final ruling, emphasizes the difficulty of proof, the serious process under Umar.
Umar questioning Abu Huraira's wealth is another anecdote.
Asks where he got it. Abu Huraira lists sources. Breeding mares, slaves work, gifts.
Umar orders him, take your capital and needs, return the rest to the state treasury. Abu Huraira objects, fails. Later check confirms he was truthful, shows Umar scrutiny.
And finally, the introduction of Firuz, Abu Lulua.
Sasani commander captured at Qadisiyah, bought by Governor Mughira, skilled craftsman, homesick in Medina, sad seeing Zoroastrian child slaves, laments, Arabs ate my liver.
Upset by perceived injustice in religion's name, remembers wife children killed when Muslims took Nihoan, sets up his motive for assassinating Umar, according to this source.
Which brings us to Uthman's caliphate and the turmoil leading to Ali. The source lists very specific accusations against Uthman.
A whole list, giving African spoils, including God Messenger share, to Marwan bin Hakam, building lots of houses for himself, family, Marwan.
Giving Bayt al-Mal funds to Marwan and others, appointing relatives as governors, giving gifts to young Umayyads with no connection to Muhammad.
Appointing Walid bin Uqba in Kufa, despite drinking claims, no Sharia punishment applied, neglecting Muhajir Ansar, no work, no consultation.
Giving land goods to unrelated people, using harsh whips instead of soft branches for punishment. It's a detailed indictment from the source's perspective.
These are presented as the reasons for the discontent leading to the siege of his house.
Right. Uthman returns with Talha, Zubair, Marwan, others, finds Egyptians besieging his gate armed, offers them dates if they eat, they're harmless. If not, he's afraid.
His defense during the siege, addressing the Muhajirun Ansar,
saying, "You criticize me like you criticized Umar, but Umar crushed you and nobody dared look at him sideways," implying his own leniency was being exploited.
And he summons Malik Ashtar during the siege.
Asks him directly, "Why are you besieging me? What do you want?" Trying direct engagement.
The source then offers Ali's perspective on the conflict, especially with Aisha, Tala, Zubair, who'd criticized Uthman with him earlier.
Ali apparently came to see it, especially after Uthman's death, as a fight for power for the caliphate. Realized times and methods were changing.
Felt he'd rushed into accepting the caliphate, put in a tough spot by Hashemites wanting to use him against Umayyads.
Surprised Muslims abandoned him for Aisha. Felt forced to proceed despite miscalculating the politics. That's the source's take on his thinking.
The Battle of Siffin is mentioned.
Ali tries to stop the fighting, sends a messenger to Malik Ashtar. Ashtar refuses, thinks victory is near. Second messenger needed to force him to stop. Ali then sends Ashaf B. Quays to see what the other side wants. Shows attempts at control, negotiation.
Ali's difficult meeting with the Karajites, who broke from him.
He explains, "I didn't want arbitration either, was forced. Arbitrators didn't rule by Korsuna. I'm preparing to fight Muawiyah again."
But the Karajites demand he first declare himself an infidel for accepting arbitration, then repent.
Ali refuses. Says he can't testify to his own disbelief after believing in Muhammad, fighting for God. That would be deviation. Shows the Karajites' rigid stance here.
The source reflects quite sadly on Ali's life and death. Says he didn't achieve success with the caliphate.
That ambiguous phrase questions if he caused victory for others. Notes his role in the Banu Qurayza event didn't give him value now. Seen as unsuccessful in the caliphate, contributing to division.
His last words after being struck by Ibn Muljam's sword, "By the Lord of the Kaaba, I have been saved."
Interpreted by the source as salvation. Relief from the tiring, lifelong chase of the caliphate dream, the missed opportunities, portrays him as weary.
Events after Ali's death show Muawiyah's rise.
Muawiyah besieges Qays bin Sa'd's force. Abdullah bin Amir besieges Hassan, Ali's son, in Medain. Hassan can't persuade his soldiers to fight.
Hassan's speech at Sabat, no ill will, soldiers dislike fighting, don't want hardship for them, agrees to surrender to Muawiyah. End of his claim.
Then Imam Hussein, Ali's other son, his journey towards Kufa.
Despite bad news from Kufa supporters suppressed, he insists on going. Why?
Source says confidence based on tens of thousands of invitation letters pledging allegiance. Believed people would rally if he arrived. His caravan supports him.
But Governor Ubaidullah bin Ziyad's soldiers meet him, try to turn him back. Yazid's orders. Can't let him enter Kufa.
Hussein refuses to pledge allegiance to Yazid. Sees it as incompatible with being imam. Decides to resist.
The commander facing him, Umar bin Sa'd, initially tries pressure. Not killing.
Tightens the circle, cuts off water from the Euphrates. After 3 days, thirst is severe. Hussein asks for water just for prayer, refused.
Abul Fazl Abbas's attempt to get water is tragic.
Goes to the river, right arm cut off, continues with water skin on left arm cut off, killed by sword blows, desperate heroism depicted.
The morning of the battle, Muharram 10, Hussein's men try reasoning with Yazid's soldiers.
Talking to familiar faces, relatives, saying their actions are sinful, don't fight.
The soldiers' perspective, per the source, feel they must obey orders, fear being rebels if they disobey the caliph state, see standing with the caliph is right.
Hussein's speech before the battle has impact.
So much so that Hur, a high-ranking commander on the other side, switches allegiance to Hussein.
Umar bin Sa'd fears more defections, orders the attack.
the battle itself, described as completely unequal.
A handful versus thousands. Not a fair fight, source says, unlike Khalid versus Salmabi. Kurfa's fighters. Hussein's group, mostly women, children, few men.
Duels happen first. Hussein kills Tamim bi Kaka Zayed bi Abtahi. Her and Habib bi Mazahir, who switched sides, are killed.
Finally, Yazid's siege of Mecca. Abdullah bi Zubayr refuses surrender. Yazid's army attacks the Kaaba with catapults, fireballs.
Kaaba's cover, roof, the ram's horn, Ishmael's ransom, catch fire. Soldiers chant while attacking. Then Yazid's sudden, unexplained death ends the siege.
Wow. After all that turbulence, the source offers some broader reflections. Islam spread, its impact.
Says Islam elevated Bedouin Arabs, but for non-Arabs, became a tool for assimilation, exploitation, leading to conflict, inequality.
Argues Arab dominance weakened as other nations recovered. This region became a graveyard of civilizations. Those who sowed violence reaped the whirlwind, basically. Consequences catching up.
This leads into discussing the Kormations. Desire for apocalypse, fighting Abbasids as Mahdi soldiers.
Seeking paradise from a tough world. Abu Tahir Suleiman trying to speed up the Mahdi's arrival. Source notes similarities to Zoroastrian converts.
Praying towards Jerusalem twice daily, fasting only 2 days, like Nauru's Mirakin, abolishing other prayers to hasten apocalypse. Hajj to Hajar in Bahrain, not Mecca.
Their attack on Mecca in 930 AD is detailed. Abu Tahir gets an envoy asking him to wait or be paid off.
His reply is pointed. Why shouldn't we enter the holy city? Is there a Sharia obstacle? Why aren't we trusted? References Muhammad Hudaybiyah doesn't want to look weak to followers, tells them not to question his pure intentions. Justification based on precedent, honor.
And the massacre that follows is described graphically. Kormations take the city quickly, chase pilgrims in Mina, Arafat.
Pilgrims urge each other to seek refuge in God, go to paradise. Kormation killing skill highlighted. Piles of bodies, blood, organs, scene called divine wrath on sinners, explicitly termed a massacre.
Okay, finally, the source shifts focus again, a case study. The siege of Ahmed, Diyarbakir.
Snapshot of Ahmed under Muslim siege. Large Syriac population worried. But Emperor Heraclius's actions made some Syriac priests prefer Umar because of his perceived justice in Jerusalem.
Yeah, which reportedly led other cities like Ruha, Haran, Samsat to surrender easily due to Syriac influence.
So surrender wasn't just fear, opportunity, Christian divisions.
Exactly. Armenian, Syriac, Greek Orthodox, Nestorian rivalries, conquest seen as a chance to change things. Power shifts mean opportunity for some, fear for others relying on current power. Churches already calculating post-war positions.
Shimon's reflection during the siege is insightful.
Here's a living Muslim is better than a dead Christian, suspects a spy, but realizes their problem is internal corruption, not just Islam.
Sees Islam's arrival like Christianity's arrival before. Religion, clergy change, not much else. If Muslims win, only changes things for those in power, he thinks.
There's that scene with Pierre in the smoky church, seeking something else.
After prayer, musicians playing rhythm. Pierre drinks, closes eyes, enters a trance journey to light, spiritual escape during hardship.
Queen Mariam's struggles are detailed. Angered by council's hopelessness, sick, refusing visitors, council ineffective, money problems hurt soldiers.
Merchant stocks dwindling. Fewer market stalls. Sarah, the merchant, fearful. Shimon sleeping in the church for safety. City crumbling from within.
The religious debate between Patriarch Abdulmasi and the Muslim Shem. Clash of theologies.
Patriarch asks, isn't our old religion better than your new one? Hisham uses the devil Adam example.
Patriarch asks, would you believe a new prophet now? Hisham, no, we're here for him, Muhammad. Patriarch struggles defending tangible Jesus versus abstract, invisible Allah. Unseen, unfelt, inspires fear promises.
Hisham quotes the Quran about multiple gods causing chaos. Abdulmasi's internal conflict is revealed.
Confesses to himself, invisible God doesn't make sense in a tangible crisis like a siege, but can't say it undermines his priesthood. Clings to belief because his role depends on it. Very personal struggle shown.
Mayaferican's response to demands.
Leaders ask for 3 days. Islijers agrees. Hisham uses the church as a base. Minorities convert to Islam due to Islagers and perceived betrayal by Abdulmasi. City divided, debate, fight weak enemy or pay jizya.
Battle for Mayaferican follows. Muslim reinforcements arrive, they win. Dabi bi Adi gathers captives, offers safety, surrender terms stated, jizya, provision shares, hosting Muslims.
Back in Ahmed, a council meeting during the siege. Grim picture.
Commander reports bad security, theft, murder, food for maybe 2 months. Poverty risks unrest. Enemies staying put, raiding neighbors, gaining allies. Byzantine aid never came.
Soldiers need meat, animals scarce. Still motivated despite poor food. Estimates Ramadan ceasefire, dire odds, 400 soldiers versus 8,000 enemy. Proposes mobilizing citizens.
The plan for Ahmed's final conquest by Khalid.
Infiltration via water channel near Watergate. 100 men, quietly enlarged channel with iron tools. Stress, fear, but death in battle seen as better than capture.
Signal for attack. Takbir shout, proposed by Iyad, accepted by Khalid.
Lastly, Su'ad bin Makran's conquests elsewhere are mentioned briefly, shows the broader expansion.
Makes deals with Kumis, Tabristan for Jizya, marches on Jurjan, meets local ruler Marzuban, Turkish leader Ruzbansul, deals with Ruzbansul for Jizya and aid, enters Jurjan with him, collects tribute. Different methods.
Wow, we have certainly navigated through an incredible breadth of material in this deep dive, really following the specific narrative threads in this source.
Yeah, from its unique take on creation and early prophecy, through all those intense political struggles, the big battles.
To really detailed accounts of social issues, succession crises, and those complex, sometimes really unexpected interactions between different religious and ethnic groups during the early conquests.
This text definitely gives a very specific, vivid, and often, yeah, challenging perspective on these foundational events and figures in early Islamic history.
It's not just a list of events, is it? It often tries to give insights into motivations, divine interventions as people saw them, and the really difficult human choices that were involved.
It lays out a particular chain of cause and effect, interpretations of why people did things, and the consequences, including some pretty graphic details and unique takes on familiar stories.
From those internal struggles over faith and power to the external conflicts and those complicated surrenders.
So for you, having listened to this deep dive into this particular narrative, it leaves us with a powerful question to consider, doesn't it?
How does engaging with historical accounts told through such specific lenses with their distinct viewpoints on faith, power, conflict, justice, how does that shape your understanding? Your understanding of religious identity, of historical events themselves, and maybe those enduring challenges communities face when dealing with change and competing claims to truth and authority.
This source offers a potent and, yes, sometimes challenging glimpse into a critical period. What aspects of it resonate most strongly with you, and what questions does it leave you with to explore further?